This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're starting our show with a discussion about history, an important judge in the history of North Dakota and the United States, and an issue that still resounds in the 21st century, the Espionage Act of 1917, which is still in statute. And joining us to talk about the judge, the Espionage Act, and an upcoming event at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum is Matthew Berning. He's a legal historian. He's a recent graduate of Augsburg University, and he's a contract researcher at the State Historical Society of North Dakota. He joins us by phone from St. Paul. Matt, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
This upcoming lecture is titled Judge Charles F. Amidon, Wartime Hysteria and the Espionage Act of 1917. It will take place at the Heritage Center and Museum Sunday in Bismarck at 2 o'clock. How did this lecture come to be?
The fall of my junior year, Michael Lansing, my advisor in the history department, reached out to me about this opportunity when Eric Holland, my boss, was looking for a student to conduct research on Judge Amidon and his role during World War I with hearing a lot of Espionage Act cases and cases related to civil liberties and free speech. And then after talking to Michael and Eric about it, we settled on a date this summer for me to conduct research on Judge Amidon. It's coming up on 2 years since I first heard about the project.
Eric Holland is the curator of education at the State Historical Society, and as you mentioned, Michael J. Lansing is the department chair in history at Augsburg University, your alma mater now. Why was Judge Amidon and this particular subject chosen?
Judge Dale Sandstrom retired from the State Supreme Court of North Dakota in 2016, and as part of his retirement, he and his clerks wanted to sponsor a series of annual legal and local history lectures. And so the lecture I'm doing is on Judge Amidon, which is being partnered with the Centennial of World War I programming in North Dakota. And it's kind of a way to pair Judge Amidon with not only contemporary issues and the programming of the State Historical Society, but in a way that really leaves a more lasting impact when you look at all that Judge Sandstrom did for the state of North Dakota.
Well, let's go back in history because I reviewed this a bit. I hadn't recalled the name of the act, but I have recalled some of the ramifications of it. How would you describe the Espionage Act of 1917?
Well, it was an act that was passed by Congress about a month after it passed the Selective Service Act, which enabled the United States government to draft young men that were of a certain age for military service in World War I. So what the Espionage Act was designed to do was root out any speech or actions that the United States government deemed to be disloyal to efforts to get men to enlist in the armed forces, to register for the draft, and just the general operations and services of the armed forces in the midst of World War I. The act itself was also very vague in its definition of what seditious or disloyal actions or speech consisted of, and it had such a wide-ranging list of offenses that constituted an offense that when Judge Amidon was exchanging letters with noted First Amendment scholar and Harvard Law School professor Zachariah Chaffee, he made a comment that it became almost impossible to not violate the act and compared it to a law that England had in the Middle Ages in which imagining the king's death would have been a violation of that law.
Oh, wow. So this really puts it at opposition, what we consider free speech in this country, and what were described as the extraordinary times that created the need to protect the draft, to sell war bonds, to prosecute the war.
Yes, absolutely.
So how did some free speech become construed as espionage?
Well, many of the remarks made by defendants in Judge Amidon's courtroom would have been considered, at least by today's standards, inflammatory, but far from illegal. A lot of them had to do with people expressing disagreement with American entry into the war, or a belief that when it came to who was being drafted, it was by and large going to be people from middle and working class backgrounds, and that owners of munitions factories and industrial corporations would benefit from the war effort. But occasionally there were defendants that also expressed views that boiled down to hoping that the United States lost the war, or just that Germany would emerge victorious. And what was significant about that was the fact that North Dakota had a very large German population, and its capital was Bismarck, after Otto von Bismarck, which, ironically, the name was chosen to actually attract German immigrants out west to North Dakota in the midst of westward expansion. Fast forward to World War I, and North Dakota brought the highest number of prosecutions per capita among all U.S. states under the Espionage Act.
Well, you mentioned North Dakota being unique, and South Dakota had plenty of Germans too. Minnesota did. There were many millions of German immigrants in the United States at that time. So this was something of a tool to suppress dissent, and because of the nature of the population in this particular state, we were a bit more under the microscope.
That would definitely be a fair assessment.
Give us a brief biography of Judge Charles Fremont Amidon.
So Judge Amidon was a U.S. District Court judge for the District of North Dakota and came from a long line of people that were dedicated to really the angle I take when I'm looking at him in my research is his role in making the United States home front safe for democracy, in reference to Woodrow Wilson's call for the United States to enter the war to make the world safe for democracy. I make the argument that he was tasked with doing so on the home front, and with regards to civil liberties and free speech. So Judge Amidon came from a long line of people with similar missions throughout their life. His first ancestor to come to America was a French Huguenot who came to Salem, Massachusetts, in the midst of the witch trials to escape religious persecution in France. And then he had ancestors who fought in the American Revolution, and his father was a radical abolitionist in upstate New York who cast the only vote for the Free Soil Party, who used his house as a frequent destination on the Underground Railroad. So Charles was really exposed between his family history and growing up with that kind, with his father and his role in the Underground Railroad, to that mission of preserving democracy in America.
Well, in this time, this 1917, when the United States enters a war that had been going on for a couple of years in Europe, the Nonpartisan League is growing in this part of the United States, particularly in North Dakota. So there's sort of a similarity in Charles Amidon's background and that kind of nascent sort of social movement that was gaining steam here. What were the Espionage Act cases that he presided over?
Some of the more notable ones were, well, there were dozens. He heard over 100 Espionage Act cases alone. And one of the some of the more noteworthy ones were U.S. v. Schutte, which was one of the first cases he heard. And in that case, the defendant was a farmer who spoke to another farmer that the whole Great War was a graft and a swindle and a rich man's war, and that if you didn't believe him, to look at the price of wheat when the United States government was engaged in food rationing and price fixing to support the war effort. And in that case, Judge Amidon established his criteria for what a valid indictment and a valid case brought before him under the Espionage Act would consist of, because one of the biggest issues he took with it was that the language was so vague and far-reaching that many of the cases never should have been brought. So over 85% of the cases he heard were dismissed because under those criteria. And U.S. v. Schutte was actually cited in a dozen future Espionage Act cases as a legal precedent. There's also the case of U.S. v. Kate Richards O'Hare, which was the first case tried in North Dakota under the Espionage Act, where Kate Richards O'Hare, a renowned Socialist Party speaker and organizer, was charged with violating the Espionage Act, and Judge Amidon was supposed to hear her case, but then had a writ of prejudice filed against him in a previous case, and also was called to serve on the Circuit Court of Appeals in St. Louis. And she had a judge that was a very outspoken opponent of hers who took a much more subjective approach to her case compared to the objective approach taken by Judge Amidon.
Well, what kind of reaction did Judge Amidon face for making these decisions? I mean, this was a highly politicized time. Emotions were pretty hot on either side of the issue, whether you're a nonpartisan league or rah-rah, let's go to war. So how did he fare given that environment?
Well, Judge Amidon was heavily criticized during the war. Many of the jurors were so either had family members serving in the war or were just so determined to prove their loyalty that he often had to direct a demurrer in which an indictment would not be brought or direct a verdict in favor of the defendant of not guilty. As far as in the community goes, he had lifelong friends and colleagues and acquaintances with whom he went from going to church and eating meals with them and such to no longer having any sort of contact with them, where they would avoid sitting with or talking to him. This extended over to his family as well. And he even received threats and at one point was burned in an effigy by North Dakotans who were angry about his approach to the law and to the Espionage Act cases he heard. But then once he retired, he was heavily praised, and the perception of him completely shifted to a much more positive light.
Well, I noted that Amidon, North Dakota, which has the distinction for being the smallest county seat in the nation, it's the county seat of Slope County, 26 people in the 2000 census, was named for him.
Judge Amidon was not only a significant judge, but a judicial reformer who brought about many reforms that were initially implemented on a local level but became national in scope. And many of his cases that he heard under the Espionage Act were cited as legal precedent by Supreme Court Justices Louis Brandeis and Felix Frankfurter.
Well, this is an interesting topic because, as I mentioned, the Espionage Act of 1917 has been amended, changed, and it's evolved over the years. It's still in place in federal statute in the 21st century. And I guess most recently, Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks guy, was charged with violating the Espionage Act by seeking classified information. So this is still an important piece of law.
It is, because under the original act, the Espionage Act, Judge Amidon, one of the major reforms he was indirectly responsible for was that because the language was so vague and how it defined a violation of the act and the number of actions that could violate it were so wide-ranging, that Judge Amidon not only required cases brought before him to have a much more clear definition for each individual case, but with all of the cases he dismissed, it eventually led the Espionage Act to be amended with more clear and definitive language a year after its original passage with the Sedition Act of 1918.
Well, I also noted, because I'm of a certain age, that in 1971, when Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times, he said, and I'm quoting this, "The current state of whistleblowing prosecutions under the Espionage Act makes a truly fair trial wholly unavailable to an American who has exposed classified wrongdoing."
It would have been nice to have a Judge Amidon at that time, I guess, you could say.
Okay. This is also, sort of an example of the intent of Congress versus the legal interpretation of what Congress passed as the Espionage Act, because I think there have been arguments made that when Congress passed the Espionage Act, they were talking about things that were truly acts of spies, of espionage, not somebody saying, I don't like the idea of us going to war and I'm not buying a Liberty Bond.
That is absolutely true, although those cases were very far and few between in the court records and Amidon's personal papers. When I looked at them, most of the cases boiled down to a disagreement for some reason or another over American entry into the war, and occasionally had to do with it ranged from not wanting to buy a Liberty Bond to disagreements over whether America had some sort of a stake in the war. But Judge Amidon also heard cases related to draft evasion, too, where men either failed to register or refused to do it, depending on the individual instance.
Well, I found an article by Kurt Eriksmoen, who writes about personages of importance to the history of North Dakota, and he published a story that was carried in papers in North Dakota back about 6 years ago. About John Fantana. He was the pastor of Peace Evangelical Church in New Salem, North Dakota, when he spoke from the pulpit as a pastor against the war, against enlistment in the military, and subsequently was brought to trial before Judge Amidon. And that decision was a little more muddied because he'd made a public proclamation in a public place. But nevertheless, he was actually voted subsequent to all of this stuff by the members of his church to remain as pastor. So clearly there were some strong feelings on both sides of the war in 1917 and 18.
Definitely. That was actually another very unique case with Judge Amidon because of how, as I mentioned, he was normally very objective in how he and how he applied the laws and listened to the cases argued before him. And in this case, Fontana did make numerous remarks that expressed favoritism towards Germany during the war, but that was prior to American entry into the war. And then after the United States declared war, he completely shifted his tone of his sermons and his prayer services towards the hope that peace could be reached between the two countries. But despite numerous testimonies of that, Judge Amidon, after he was found guilty, admonished him during the sentencing and accused him of having his body in America but his heart and mind back home in Germany during the war.
Well, this just shows the devil's in the details about things that are sometimes passed in Congress and have to be adjudicated by the legal divisions of the United States. This is the Espionage Act of 1917, the upcoming lecture by Matt Berning at the State Historical Society at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum is titled Judge Charles F. Amidon, Wartime Hysteria and the Espionage Act of 1917. It's Sunday at 2 o'clock. It's free and open to the public. And thank you for spending some time with us today, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on Main Street, Natural North Dakota.
Prairie Public is proud to present A Night of Great Jazz under the stars at Sleepy Hollow Arts Park in Bismarck. Wednesday, August 14th at 7 p.m. Central as Kansas City Jazz meets Bismarck Jazz.
Hi, this is Scott Prebis. If you attend only one jazz event this year, make it this one. It's your rare chance to hear four enormous talents from the jazz historical hotbed of Kansas City and a talented cadre of Bismarck musicians in a beautiful setting.
Prairie Public's very own Scott Prebis and Darren King represent our capital city, while vocalist Ebony Fondren, guitarist Rod Fleeman, sax man Jim Mayer, and pianist Justin Binnick show off their chops from the city where jazz grew up. Two great cities, a night of great jazz at Sleepy Hollow Arts Park in Bismarck, August 14th at 7 p.m. Central. Tickets available at Eckerhoff Music, Direct Travel, or at the door. Sponsored by the Radisson Hotel in Bismarck, Bistro Bismarck, and Arts Midwest.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. Chuck Lura is a biologist who writes and voices Natural North Dakota. As a teacher and a student of nature, his inquiring mind is occasionally directed by a question he couldn't answer. That's the subject of today's essay.
I recently received a call about a clam at Lake Metegoshi. The caller had found one in the sediment along his shoreline and was wondering about it. I've never seen any clam shells around the lake, much less a live one. But with a little help from a colleague at Valley City State University, I tentatively identified it as a giant floater. I don't know much about clams, so I had to do some investigating. Clams have interesting common names. Fat mucker, Wabash pigtoe, creek heel splitter, deer toe, plain pocketbook. I checked Van Vera's Aquatic Mussels of North Dakota from 1983. He documented 13 species of what are generally referred to as clams in the state, along with 13 species of pill clams, which are very small clams in the order of a few millimeters in length. He also documented 22 species of snails in the state. The giant floater has a widespread range, occupying the Mississippi and Missouri River drainages, as well as the St. Lawrence and in Canada from western Ontario to Alberta. It occupies a variety of habitats, but is mainly in the muddy bottoms of lakes and in areas of rivers and streams with slow-moving water. It's a filter feeder, of course, and probably consumes mainly algae, but likely other microscopic life. Sexuality and life cycles are variable in clams. Some species, for example, have both male and female reproductive organs. Others may start out as male, but become females as they age. A giant floater is either male or female, and they have an interesting life cycle. Fertilized eggs are held in the female for around 11 months in brood tubes where they develop into larvae. The larvae, or glaucidia, are then released into the water and must attach to the gill filaments or the body surface of a host fish. But not just any species of fish will do. Known hosts for the giant floater include bluegills, black crappie, a few species of shiners and darters, creek chubs, and brook stickleback. After a few days, or perhaps weeks, the larvae become juveniles and release from the host. They then find a place in the substrate to develop into adults. If you've seen a few clam shells in our region, you've probably seen a giant floater. I put a picture of it along with the text of this natural North Dakota. You can access it at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
If you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question, it's easy to contact us. Just email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or send us a message via Facebook, where we are Main Street at Prairie Public. And you can still call toll-free 888-755-6377.
Coming up on Main Street, another excerpt from a series of LGBTQ oral histories and a TEDx Fargo presentation about protecting the environment. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Housing officials got a chance to bend the ear of HUD Secretary Ben Carson during a roundtable discussion in Grand Forks this morning. The meeting followed a visit to the $9 million LaGrave on First project, which provides housing and services for the chronically homeless. Carson says getting the right services to those in need pays long-term dividends.
And as we develop our people, they become resources for us. And, you know, they become contributors. In the long run, it costs us less money, not more.
Many of those in attendance stress the need for local flexibility when working with federal programs. Carson says it takes the state, federal, and local sector working together to get things done.
It takes a long time. If you're going to do this at the federal level, you have to contact this person, then it has to go through this office, and this. By the time it gets back, whatever the need was is multiplied significantly.
Carson traveled to North Dakota at the invitation of U.S. Senator John Hoeven. He has also traveled to Fort Totten to meet with Spirit Lake tribal leaders. Grand Forks health officials want to take a shot at setting up a syringe service program, sometimes referred to as an exchange program. The goal is to reduce the transmission of hepatitis C and HIV due to the sharing of needles. Programs are currently up and running in Fargo, Mandan, and Minot. Grand Forks Opioid Response Coordinator Michael Doolitt says around 300 people have gone through the doors in Fargo and another 200 in Mandan.
The number of people that are connected to treatment, it generally is still relatively low. Addiction is a chronic relapsing brain disease. A lot of people aren't necessarily ready to enter into treatment when they're coming into the program. According to the Department of Health, between January 2018 and December 2018, 85 of those individuals were referred into a treatment program.
A federal grant would cover the bulk of the costs in Grand Forks, with private dollars picking up the rest of the tab. The goal is to have the Grand Forks program up and running by October. And Governor Doug Burgum and First Lady Catherine Burgum were among those on hand to mark the grand opening of a new recovery and treatment center in Fort Totten.
The facility is ready. The facility is gorgeous. The location is beautiful. It's a very calming place. It feels good down there. It just, yeah, like it was always meant to be.
Cynthia Lindquist is president of Chandesca Chicana Community College. She says the 15-bed residential addiction center will provide a much-needed service for the Spirit Lake community.
There's no local treatment options. They'd have to go north up to Grafton or down to Jamestown, and then it's relative to beds and all that. And so part of the vision of this project is a local community-based program to at least begin the initial aspects of treatment and then to make sure there's cultural competency, family dynamic to that treatment process.
Lindquist says the project was funded in part by a grant from the United Health Foundation. Over the past 2 years, crews have been busy remodeling and refashioning the former group home. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Breaking Barriers, Harvesting LGBTQ Stories from the Northern Plains is an oral history project of the Red River Rainbow Seniors. It gathers stories from residents who grew up during a time when being out was not a practical consideration. In this excerpt, we hear from Robert Ubull as he visits with volunteer Mark Chicola.
When were you first aware of your gay inclinations or identity?
Well, I suppose probably not really until I was about 18, until I was a freshman in college. But I'd have to say I don't think I was ready. I don't think I was ready to fully accept myself, and I think I was taking a few steps out of the closet, but I think I scared myself back in. That was 1977. But, I mean, I know in retrospect I just wasn't ready at that age. I had too many other things I think I had to deal with first before I was able to accept my gay identity. Although I do remember, you know, at the age of about 12, 13, I knew something about me was different. But the way I thought of, I remember I thought to myself that I wouldn't get married. I thought, you know, I'm not someone who will get married. And I think in a certain way, I subconsciously realized my interest in men. But it was certainly not something conscious at that time, not as a young teenager.
Well, describe your process of coming out in terms of how you went from that to sort of fully accepting your gay identity.
Well, I think after I scared myself into the closet, I basically had about 10 years of denial, extreme denial. And I think it really began to take a toll on my mental health. I began to have, I think, any number of problems because I was repressing who I was. And I think what really opened the door for me to be able to accept myself as a gay man was the therapy I went through. It was a group for adult children of alcoholics. I think that group was very important for me. I mean, it helped me resolve a number of issues that I'd been struggling with. And I remember admitting to one of the facilitators of the group that I thought I might be gay. At that point, once I started saying the words out loud, it seemed to come very quickly that, oh, okay, yes, I'm gay. and was able to, you know, finally admit that to myself. I mean, because I'd even been engaged in a great deal of denial with myself. It wasn't that I was hiding from other people. I mean, I was hiding from myself all that time, you know, coming up with all sorts of excuses to try to explain away things about myself, dreams, or whatever.
When you finished your PhD, soon after that, you took a position at North Dakota State University, is that right?
That's correct.
Why don't you tell us something about that?
Well, I had gotten a temporary position at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff. And so we moved down to Flagstaff. I taught for a year.
And that was with your partner, Ted Broff.
My then partner, now husband, Ted Broff. Then in our third year in Flagstaff, I had to get a job just to earn some money. I ended up working in a motel for a while. And then also used that time to start applying for teaching positions and received an offer from North Dakota State University in Fargo. And so we moved to Fargo in the summer of 1992. And I had gotten a hold of a book called In Search of Gay America by a man named Neil Miller. And one of the places he had visited was Fargo-Moorhead. And he talked about our then mayor, John Lindgren, and what he was doing to advocate for LGBT people. And I had to say that really made it easier to accept the position, knowing that knowing that there was at least a supportive mayor in office. I did have some concerns about going to North Dakota in 1989 as a gay man.
Now, you and Ted are married. When did that occur?
That occurred 4 years ago, on the very first day that it became legal in Albuquerque to marry. I knew there was a case that was going to be decided, and it was on a Monday afternoon when it was decided. Came home that evening and asked him, I said, Ted, should we get married tomorrow? Would you like to do that? And he said, yes, let's do it. So the next morning, he called his supervisor, I called my supervisor, and we said, I'm sorry, we won't be coming in, we're getting married today.
Before same-sex marriage was legalized, do you think you and Ted would have wanted to marry?
Definitely. Hmm. Definitely. I mean, we had a commitment ceremony back in 1991, which, by the way, was officiated by Ted's mother. So yes, we very much would have liked to legally marry before we did.
So you lived in Fargo-Moorhead for a number of years, and then now you're living in a larger urban area, and it sounds to me like you, in some ways, you feel that your social life, your community life in Fargo-Moorhead, and the time you were there compares really favorably with your social life in Albuquerque.
Definitely. And I think we were able to, I think because we were a smaller community, I think we depended more on each other. Although I've noticed a great difference, because I think because the general climate in Fargo-Moorhead was less accepting than here, I think we looked more to each other. Here in New Mexico, we've had generally favorable experiences. People just don't seem to care if you're gay. It's not an issue. You know, people register it and acknowledge it, but they just don't seem to care. It's not a big deal here.
One of the things I'd like to ask you is how being gay has changed over your lifetime in terms of how people treat you, how you see yourself, and how you interact with others.
Well, I think part of me has gotten to the point that if someone has a problem with LGBT people, unless it's the person I really need to deal with, say, in a work context, or even someone perhaps in my family, you know, then I'm not willing to make time for that person. I won't fight. I won't try to convince that person. I just don't have that kind of time and energy because there are far too many people out there for whom being gay is not an issue, and I would rather find those people. I think it is easier. I mean, just in general, as time has passed, attitudes have changed. People are less uptight about LGBT people in general. Although we see that transgender people are getting the same treatment, the same awful treatment that gay and lesbian people were getting, say, 30, 40 years ago, and the same kinds of absurd charges are being made against transgender people. But, I mean, overall, our community is treated better than it was, and I think we're seen more as full human beings entitled to respect and dignity and equality under the law, and those are all good things. But there'll always be some group that people want to look down on, and in our community right now, it's transgender people, and that makes me very sad because we've been through this so many times, and you would think that people might have learned by now, but they haven't. But I'm very optimistic about the future. I mean, I see things just getting better. I mean, young people are so unconcerned about these kinds of issues, and to most young people, gay people are just part of the landscape. They're just a normal part of humanity. They've grown up with that attitude, and I think that's a wonderful thing.
Again, that excerpt comes to us from the Red River Rainbow Seniors Oral History Project called Breaking Barriers, Harvesting LGBTQ Stories from the Northern Plains. Interviewer Mark Ciccola was visiting with Robert Ubull. Excerpts edited by Prairie Public are published as the Breaking Barriers podcast. Eventually, all the oral histories will be available as part of North Dakota State University archives. And it's an ongoing project. If you wish to get involved, you can contact Red River Rainbow Oral History at gmail.com. Details of this week's Pride events can be found at fmpride.com. There's bowling, trivia, and youth events, a dance party, a 5K run, a block party, Pride in the Park, even a pet contest, and the Pride Parade. It winds up with an interfaith service Sunday at noon at the Fargo Theater. Coming up on Main Street, another TEDx Fargo presentation.
There's free beer up at the castle on National Day in Liechtenstein.
It's an amazing day to be there. There's a huge outdoor party.
Find the best all-natural gelato in Italy and avoid the artificial stuff.
In nature, bright colors are usually a sign of danger.
And frolic among the heather in the moorlands of England.
One other tip is don't walk into a bog, although you'll be there 2,000 years later.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Some of life's major problems seem so big, we may feel powerless as individuals. Marshall Johnson says individuals have power to promote change. Johnson is the vice president of the National Audubon Society and executive director of Audubon Dakota. His mission is to make the earth a healthy place for hikers, farmers, birders, hunters, and everyone else. During TEDx Fargo in July, he highlighted how we can make a difference as individuals and by teaming up.
I hate Earth Day. You don't know how cathartic that is for me. I've been wanting to say it in public for years, but I hate Earth Day. And you're probably wondering, how could he say that? How could he think that? He's a conservationist, isn't he? Well, I am a conservationist, but I'm also a millennial, which makes me skeptical, cynical, and I live to tear down well-established traditions and institutions. But Earth Day, some of you can relate to that, right? But Earth Day, the notion that we could relegate all that Earth gives to us every day to just a day or a week or even a month has always seemed underwhelming to me. And in the face of our current environmental challenges, it's time that we make every day Earth Day. In particular, I work in the grasslands ecosystem. The good news is we have 370 million acres of grasslands remaining. The bad news, that represents less than one half of the historic grasslands ecosystem. When we lose grasslands, we lose so much more than something just pretty to look at. We lose the ecosystem services and the wildlife that are obligate to this landscape. Birds are the prism through which Audubon views our work, and the grassland birds are of the most imperiled in the entire world. Most of them have experienced 50% decrease over the last 100 years. And we're all very familiar with global bee collapse. This is particularly chilling to our food supply when you think that one in every three bites of food that you eat is a result of the pollination that bees provide. I bet you they think a thing or two about us, don't they? When we lose grasslands, we lose so much more. When we lose grasslands and wetlands, it impacts our rivers, streams, and tributaries, the vital vines and arteries of America's heartland. Our rivers are constantly losing the ability to process pollutants and nutrients. When our rivers dump out into the Gulf of Mexico today, there's a dead zone that's being created, a layer where no marine life can survive. Today, that dead zone is bigger than the state of New Jersey. And we've all been hit by or know someone that's been affected by springtime flooding. Also, a major driver when you lose wetlands and grasslands. But why? And here's where I geek out a little bit on grasslands. Grasslands are a dynamic ecosystem. What you see is not what you get with grasslands. If you see a prairie plant that is, say, 3 feet tall, that there is more than 3 to 4 times that beneath the surface. And that is where the magic happens. Grasslands, the deep root systems, when compared to your lawn grass at home, there is no comparison. Those deep root systems can sequester more than 5 to 15 metric tons of carbon out of the atmosphere every year. Make no doubt about it, the preservations of grasslands are vital to humanity's need for a secure climate future. That amount is equal to between 60 and 100 cars' emissions annually. Grasslands also act as incredible catchments for water, taking in rainwater, processing it, storing it, purifying it, and slowly moving it to our rivers, streams, tributaries, and recharging our clean water aquifers. These are what we call ecosystem services, those important functions that grasslands give us. And they're largely provided for us on private farms and ranches. 90% of America's grasslands are either owned or managed by America's cattle rancher. And we don't pay for those vital ecosystem services, do we? When you buy beef or poultry off the ranch, you're only paying for currently the bottom line cost of production. But what they're giving us is so much more. This began to dawn on me about 8 years ago. I became the vice president of National Audubon Society when I was 24. And I remember completing my first conservation project. And I do mean me because I was vice president of one, just me. I was the only staff member. I've got an incredible team, and they're here in the audience today. But back then, it was just me. And I completed this project with Todd and Cindy Brown up from the northwest corner of the state. And I remember when we got done with that project, it was a grazing project there on some of our land, some of his land. Todd, we had lunch out there, and Todd said to me, "Marshall, this just worked out perfect. We're non-traditional partners in this, but that's okay. You don't care about my cattle, and I can't keep track of all the LBBs out there, little brown birds." And in that 5.5 hours of driving home, I began to think, you know, there's more to the partnership that Todd and I can have. I better be concentrated and focused on his cattle and his bottom line. How can we develop something that can reward our ranchers and empower you to support ranchers in their ability to be climate solutions, to be environmental solutions of some of our biggest problems today? Luckily for me, I work for the National Audubon Society, and we're full of crazies. And sometimes you need crazies. And about 5 or 6 years ago, we began to develop a market-based solution that put you at the center of conservation. Let's face it, the era of big conservation is over. You have to drive the outcomes for the next 100 years. And the market is a perfect place to do that. So what did we do? We went out and created a market-based program, certification program, where we certify in the area of animal welfare, habitat management, environmental stewardship. We set the bar really high. And the ranches that enroll in the program are third-party audited to give you that confidence. We leverage our brand and hope that we can all partake through our purchasing power in supporting ranches that want to do the right thing, want to be a solution for the future. Cattle play a vital role out on the landscape for grasslands. They mimic in many ways what historic bison used to do. That's why we need cattle out on the landscape. Today, the Audubon Conservation Ranching Program enrolls more than 2 million acres across several states and 70 ranches. I'm proud of where we've come, but we've got to do so much more. And I know it's hard. Remember, I'm cynical and skeptical, so I understand looking for all these certifications is hard, but we have to do our research. We have to be a part of the solution. We can't allow our cynicism to be our crutch anymore, our skepticism to be an excuse. Ranchers stand at the ready and willing to support the next 100 years of environmental conservation. Finally, friends, you are what hope looks like to a bird. You are what hope looks like to this landscape. Without you, everything I've talked about will go the way of department stores and dinosaurs. It won't last. So please, do me a favor. Put the power into your next purchase. Do your research. Search out foods that are better for you and better for the land. Go out and shop and eat like the world depends on it. Together, with clarity of purpose and our planet as the stakes, let us be on our way. Thank you.
That was Marshall Johnson, Vice President of the National Audubon Society and Executive Director of Audubon Dakota. He spoke during July's TEDx Fargo. Dakota Datebook is next.
I'm Peter Sagal. Studies show that the secret to human happiness is a spiffy new car. No, really, it's science. So when it's time to trade up for bliss, donate your used car to us, and we'll turn it into the programs you love.
Just call 844-440-6900 or visit us online at prairiepublic.org/car.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 7th. She was a charming lyric soprano with a voice like a nightingale. Her name was Norma Fauchild, and she was a noteworthy Norwegian-American singer and vocal teacher for 50 years. And for several of those years, she was a soprano soloist with the legendary band of John Philip Sousa. But at heart, Nora was always a Minot girl. Born in Norway in 1898, the daughter of Julius and Inga Fauchild, she came to America at the age of 6 months. Nora's father was a homesteader who later became owner of the New York hardware store in Minot. Minot was Nora's childhood home, where she began singing as soon as she began to talk, with her first public appearance being a church Christmas celebration at age 2 and a half. She studied violin and piano and performed many solos in church. After her 1917 high school graduation,
Nora studied at the Institute of Musical Art in New York City, which would become the Juilliard School. After her graduation, Nora took operatic training in Europe. Upon her return, Nora became a soloist at Flatbush Reformed Church in Brooklyn. When John Philip Sousa held auditions for singers, Nora tried out, as a wager with a friend who had wondered if a church soloist would fit in with a military band. Much to Nora's surprise, the world-famous Sousa chose the 25-year-old to be the youngest soloist ever employed by the renowned musical troupe. From 1923 to circa 1926, Nora sang classics like "The Lark Now Leaves His Watery Nest," "Carry Me Back to Old Virginia," and "Dixie." Her wondrous soprano voice delighted 3 million people yearly. Nora Fauchild's voice impressed the audience, wrote the Los Angeles Times, as a high lyric coloratura, with plenty of artistic talent to handle difficult trills and cadenzas splendidly. After touring with Sousa, Nora settled down in Connecticut, marrying vocal instructor George Morgan, and they had 3 children. She continued singing and teaching. At age 73, Nora died of cancer on December 10, 1971. On this date in 1930, a Minnesota newspaper profiled this North Dakota vocalist's career from Minot to Juilliard to Berlin and beyond. According to the journalist, Nora's life story, with all her musical accomplishments, had an almost too-good-to-be-true quality. Said Nora later about the years she spent crisscrossing America and how her songs inspired audiences, "Mr. Sousa was very good to me." Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
A Veterans Affairs program is designed to provide support to family caregivers of injured vets.
She does a lot. Without her, I don't know where I'd be at this point.
But the VA has faced criticism for kicking vets off the program for reasons that seem arbitrary. We'll examine the controversy surrounding the Caregiver Assistance Program at the VA on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, South Sudan is the world's newest country, and it's a very troubled land. Almost 3/4 of its people cannot read. Niamal Day founded South Sudan Reads to combat illiteracy, and we'll talk about her work during our show on Thursday. Sue Balcom joins us for a discussion about all things watermelon in this week's Main Street Eats, and we'll have our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. And in the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.